Dr. Google can't fix your knee. The Joint Relief Institute can. Fast joint pain relief, covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Kirk Wallace Johnson has written The Feather Thief, a book about a 20-year-old American named Edwin Rist, who in 2009 stole rare, irreplaceable, beautiful birds from the archives of the British Museum of Natural History. In this book, you learn about the evolution of birds, the beauty of some, the desire to put their feathers and sometimes whole skins in hats in the last two centuries, and how that nearly decimated populations that evolved untouched for centuries. The value of the feathers soared. Fly fishermen tied their feathers into lures that were not only effective, but themselves intricate, detailed works of art. Eventually, activists in changing mores and styles changed the laws around the world, protecting the remaining stock. But specimens hundreds of years old were kept in museums for study, which led one fly fishing enthusiast named Edwin to covet and steal, use, and sell them. This is the story of that crime, and as importantly, the aftermath. Kirk, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
I got to tell you, a friend of mine, Steve Bertrand, here at the radio station, said, you ought to read this book. It looks kind of interesting, and it's the sort of book I think you can appreciate for the story itself, but it's a great example of a book that tells you about the world at that time and even now, sort of through that filter, through that lens. If you said, hey, everybody, I've got this great book and it's about fly fishing flies and a guy who stole some, nobody wants to read that book. But the way you tell it, it's mesmerizing. Every page, every detail, every sort of thing that you take us through is really fascinating.
Oh, thank you. I'm thrilled you liked it. And you know, just for what it's worth, I didn't really know anything about any part of this world or these worlds before I started, but I almost couldn't believe what kept unfolding as I started digging around.
Yeah. Well, you've got a pretty good ear for a story, though, because as it was first told to you, it was a curiosity, but I don't know that I would have pursued it with the zeal you did. Why don't you walk us through this? How did you first find out about this story?
Well, it's hard to believe, but it was nearly 7 years ago now. I was waist high in a frigid river in northern New Mexico fly fishing for trout. And I had kind of become obsessed with fly fishing because I was at a point in my own life where I had spent nearly 8 years trying to confront the consequences of the Iraq War. I'd previously served over there as the head of the reconstruction of Fallujah for USAID, and then spent the subsequent many years fighting on behalf of Iraqis who had become refugees because they worked for us as interpreters. And I just was overwhelmed, and I found that the only peace of mind that I could get in my life was just going up into the mountains and fishing, and your cell phone signal doesn't tend to work there, and all that matters is how quiet and deliberate you are. And while I was fishing this day, the guide that I had hired to kind of teach me the peculiarities of that particular river opens up his fly box, and I catch this flash of this stunning thing. It was emerald and crimson and yellow and turquoise, and it was a salmon fly tied according to a Victorian recipe that was 150 years old, and I'd never seen anything like it. And we started talking about this, what is now really essentially an art form, and he said to me, he's like, well, you think that's interesting, you should hear about this American kid that just broke into the British Museum of Natural History to steal hundreds of exotic birds to sell to obsessive fly tiers so that he could buy a golden flute. And after he said that, I just kind of froze, and I thought no reasonable person could hear that sentence and not want to find out more.
So you started to look into it.
I did, and initially, I thought it was just so strange that it must have been just, you know, gossip or a rumor or something. But as soon as I started poking around, you know, I would go onto these private forums and Facebook groups, and I would start seeing these transactions of oftentimes protected bird specimens within the community of Victorian salmon fly tiers, and these things would start disappearing. So I started feverishly printing things out before they were deleted. I went to a fly tying symposium or convention in New Jersey where one fly tier gave me a not-so-subtle threat to buzz off and not to write anything about this if I knew it was good for me.
Yeah.
But every thread that I tugged on uncovered something new, and what I realized was that the kid had done this. He had gotten caught, but through some fancy lawyering had essentially gotten away with it, and by the time that I heard about this, no one was looking for hundreds of these missing birds, which
right.
were worth a lot of money.
Well, that's the thing. It's the search not only for the criminal and his trial and the outcome of that, but then the search for the missing, you know, loot. What happened to the birds that he stole? Tell us who Edwin Rist is.
So Edwin Rist is a virtuoso flautist from New York who started studying the flute at, I think, 6 years old. And when he was around 10 or 11, he discovered the world of fly tying. And there was something that just captivated him about the difficulty and the intricacy of these patterns. I mean, one important thing to recognize is that you know, when you fish for trout, you're using these kind of ugly-looking small flies that are made to mimic real insects in the water. But salmon flies are just kind of gaudy works of art, and salmon are not even feeding at that point when they're spawning. They're just striking out of aggression. So you could catch salmon with dog fur on a hook. None of this stuff has any biological basis to it. But there's a really kind of refined art form that says if to do it right, you've got to use this one feather from this bird in New Guinea and then two feathers from this bird in Brazil. And so he really thrived at doing this, but the problem was that most of the birds are very hard to get now in the 21st century. And so for all of his talents, he was kind of constantly longing for the feathers and the birds that he couldn't possess because they were always either unavailable or they would be scooped up on eBay by wealthier men than him.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting that maybe the sort of focus and discipline you need to apply to a musical instrument, the flute, you might also need to apply to the intricate detail of tying with tiny instruments, looking through a magnifying lens, a fishing lure. Both of them require, I think, a similar sort of personality or set of skills, if you will. And by the age of, 18, he was not only one of the best flautists of his generation, he was regarded as one of the best fly tiers in the world, too.
That's right. In fact, there's a magazine called Fly Tire Magazine that the editors hailed him as the future of fly tying. and you know what's interesting? There's an inordinate number of dentists that do fly tying too. So that's to your point.
Yeah. You know, and isn't it interesting? Isn't it fun as you write the book? Certainly, as I read it, that every now and then you just discover a whole parallel universe out there, a world that you had no idea existed. In this case, the international community of salmon fly tiers, but they're out there.
Yeah, and you know, it sounds ridiculous. Like, and here's a bunch of men, and it's almost only men that do this, and they're all obsessed with tying these things that they're not even going to fish. Most of these guys don't even know how to fish. But what I thought was for a long time was just kind of a quirky subculture. This crime and the aftermath, I think, made me realize that as strange as this hobby might seem to people, in the end, it's still a group of people bound by these really primal themes of greed, of obsession, of addiction to to hard to get materials, the kind of moral compromises that we make in the pursuit of these obsessions, and betrayal of in the end in terms of people who spoke to me and ratted out others, and suddenly this became something that was much larger than just some quirky dudes and their salmon flies.
Yeah. Well, Edwin becomes obsessed, as you say, many people in that community are, with getting the right birds and feathers. The birds of paradise come up a lot in your writing. And so he discovers that at the British Museum of Natural History, while he's over there learning music for 4 years, they have archives, collections. Literally, the birds are housed in file cabinets, it sounds like. He sees them and decides he's going to steal some of them, right?
Yeah, he described the moment that he first saw them, and your listener should recognize that these are not like what you would see in the public part of a museum where their wings are outstretched. These are scientific specimens, so their wings are pulled tight against their body and their legs are pulled against their torso so that they can be stored in thousands of cabinets which have thousands of drawers. This is the second largest collection on the face of the planet, and there are, I think, around 800,000 of these birds there.
800,000 birds.
And it might sound like an absurd number, but these collections are just critical to the march of human knowledge. If you have a bird from 1850 and another one from 1900 and 1950... that equips scientists with all kinds of abilities to make inferences by comparing what's changed in that 100-year stretch. And I mean, we're constantly dislodging new facts about the world around us through these collections. I mean, the Field Museum in Chicago has, I think they have a couple hundred thousand birds there. But he described his first visit, which he made under false pretenses, to the collection as being inside the middle of Fort Knox, that like the value represented in those cabinets was so staggering that your brain almost fails to comprehend it. He spent the next 7 months plotting his return under cover of night so that he could go back and take them for himself.
Yeah. You know, the value of the birds, I think, is important to just touch on briefly. And you're right. I think that anything that beautiful will naturally be coveted. Anything that rare will naturally be coveted. And so that the museum has these, I think, you might say, well, they will keep them just because there aren't any 200-year-old beautiful birds like this left, and we're going to keep this stock and save it for aesthetic reasons, if nothing else. But no, there's a scientific reason to study them. The fly tying community doesn't think that. They more sense that the museums of the world are just hoarding them because they can. The real value of those birds would be to sell them, take the millions of dollars, and let the fly community tie beautiful lures with them. I guess the point is, either way, they're really valuable. But as you said, to the march of human understanding, you cannot replace them.
And that is what animated my search for these things, because when I realized that this was, in effect, a theft from humanity. I mean, many of these birds have been in this collection since before the word scientist was even coined, before we even knew what DNA was, or we had the concept of genetic inheritance. There have been generations of researchers that have used each new generation of technology to examine the same birds. And so, for example, we understand the impact of DDT pesticides by being able to study the eggs in these collections, and
right,
we could see that as soon as they were introduced, the eggshells got thinner and less viable. We just recently, scientists did a study of seabirds and definitively established that mercury levels are rising in the ocean by being able to compare 135 years worth of specimens. These birds have answers to questions that people haven't even thought of yet. And in stealing these things for personal pleasure, the feather thief essentially stole from all of us and from future human knowledge.
Yeah.
And that's where I really felt like, well, this is crazy. I'm going to go find these things and try to get them back.
You got angry. I mean, it's weird, Kirk. You sort of, it became personal for you.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a sense that, I guess I have a very keenly tuned mind towards when I see there's an injustice and something isn't being done about it, that really just sticks in my craw, so to speak. And because of some very fancy lawyering, he never spent a night behind bars.
And well, hold on, wait 1 second. So he eventually plots it out. He breaks through the window. He goes through the archives. He tells him he takes a suitcase. How many? He put 297 birds or something like that in the suitcase?
299, yeah.
299, and then he escapes. And months later, nobody knows until randomly a couple of guys talking at a bird show, a feather thing, say, one guy says something to another, and because of the internet and social chat rooms, it sort of comes to light that he may be the guy. Who sort of discovered that Edwin was the criminal?
Yeah, so it wasn't the British police. It wasn't the museum, even though the feather thief's own name and signature were in their logbook, and they very easily could have
looked it up and said,
looked it up.
Who's been here in the last few years? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The way that this all came crashing down was, there was an undercover detective in the police service of Northern Ireland. So this is someone who was not assigned to this case. It was a guy who had taken up fly tying as a way of keeping sane during these 12, 15-hour stakeouts in some unmarked van during the Troubles. And he was at a fly tying festival in a small Dutch town of Zwolle, and he was just kind of walking around, and he saw this guy showing off a bunch of really exotic and rare materials, and it looked like a museum specimen to him. You could tell because they have cotton eyeballs instead of glass eyeballs, and he started kind of, you know, asking him where he bought this stuff, and the guy said, "Oh, I bought it from this American in England named Edwin Rist." And it was because of that guy, who I referred to as Irish because I keep his anonymity in the book, but because of a tip from Irish, that's when the authorities finally turned their sights on him. But this was a full 15 months.
Yeah.
The arrest didn't happen until 15 months after the heist, at which point the majority of skins had either been chopped up or sold off.
He eventually then gets arrested, and he goes on trial. His poor parents, you know, they've got this son who is going to maybe be one of the world's great flautists. He already is tracking that way. And they get a call saying, "I'm arrested for stealing feathers." His brother had heard about the crimes because his brother was a fly-tying enthusiast, too, and burst into tears. At the trial, they get an attorney, and how does he... And he admitted to the crime. He said, "Yes, I stole the feathers. I stole the birds." How does he get off?
Yeah, so that's the kicker. Because he admitted his guilt the minute the cops walked into his apartment the day of the arrest, it went straight to sentencing, which meant that the investigation essentially concluded at that point. They handed off to prosecution. And at the time, there was a very high-profile case in the UK about a Scottish hacker with Asperger's that had hacked into the Pentagon, and the U.S. was trying to extradite him, but when it became clear that he had Asperger's, the Brits said, "Nuts to that, we're not gonna let you take him." And I don't know if that colored his lawyer's thinking, but he was placed before a pretty preeminent scholar in Asperger's, who was given a set of questions from the defense attorney saying, "Hey, does this young man have Asperger's? And if so, does that explain why he took the birds?" Now, never mind that he admitted in the interrogation that he stole the birds for money. But the psychologist said, yes, he has Asperger's. The poor kid just was driven by an uncontrollable obsession, and he almost had to take these things.
He wasn't motivated by money. This wasn't a crime like that. It was just a driving sort of autistic thing that he couldn't control.
Yes, and then I should say I have no axe to grind against the concept of Asperger's. I think I have people in my extended family with it. There's no part of me that has cynicism about that, about the concept of Asperger's. But in this case, there's a real soft spot, it would seem, in the British justice system, because the judge, when he saw this, this basically bound his hands, because this story just gets crazier and crazier, but there was a grave robber in Bristol with Asperger's who never spent a night behind bars, or who was later released on appeal. And when the judge saw that precedent, he essentially said to the court, well, I can't do anything. I can't send him to prison because I know he's going to be released on appeal.
So he said, go ahead.
All we can do is wish you luck.
So then he gets, he graduates. He goes on to pursue his musical career. He walks away. He has a $250,000 fine or $300,000 fine, but
which wasn't collected.
Yeah.
So it's, and because this was such an embarrassment to the British Museum, that this was such a brazen heist and it took them so long to figure it out, I think they were content to just say, okay, we're pleased the matter is resolved, is the direct quote from the head of the museum. I think they were just thrilled that the media might move on and that this wouldn't continue to be an embarrassment. But what no one was talking about was that they only had recovered a portion of the birds on the day of the arrest. And there was a huge number, roughly a third or so, that were unaccounted for, and no one was looking for them. And I'm in all of these forums and at these fly tying festivals, and I see these guys joking about the Tring heist. The museum is in Tring, England. And I see things on eBay that look suspiciously like museum specimens. There was like smoke coming out of my ears. I was like, how is this possible that no one is doing anything anymore about this? And that's really where the gears changed for me, because I then kind of made it a personal mission that if the Brits weren't going to find these things for themselves, then I was going to go out and find it for them, because I believed in the mission of research and science, and that they knew better what to do with these things than a bunch of greedy fly tires.
Yeah, that's interesting. And by the way, Kirk Wallace Johnson's on the line, and we're talking about the book, The Feather Thief, which you should read. I won't page by page dissect it with you much further here, Kirk. But we are, as we are talking now about your book, we're only at the halfway point. This would be where most books end, where the guy then gets away and you go, holy cow, can you believe that? End of story. That's only halfway through the book, because now it is, there's only one person on the planet, literally, that cares so much about this story that the second half of the book gets written, and that's you. The museum had checked out. The police no longer needed to investigate the crime. The fly tying community didn't want to know, and some of them maybe knew, but they didn't know what the hell they were talking about. But you made it your personal mission. I'll tell you what, you got engaged in this period of time, and I don't know how.
I know, and I somehow also have had two children in this period of time, so it's this all seems, looking back, it seems I don't know how I finished this, but that's also the other issue, is that I don't know if I ever will feel like I've finished it, but you know, really, this was a just classic, almost like old-fashioned dragnet investigation.
Yeah.
Where no one wanted to talk to me at the beginning. I had a huge sheet of paper, and I put Edwin's name at the middle of it, and I started writing down everybody in this community that I knew anything about, and I if two of them had a fight with each other on the forum, I would approach one and try to flip them against the other, and I would start working my way ring by ring
but
closer
to Edwin. To what end, Kirk? Why? I mean, like, in the back of your mind, we're going, because if I can solve this, I'll get a book deal? I mean, there was no reward. I'm like, how are you financing this, and why are you so into this?
Well, now you're making me embarrassed, but the, you know, initially, you know, I was still doing this while I was running an organization and trying to get the refugees out. And there were days where I would testify before Congress and then go back to my hotel room and log into these forums and take screenshots of illicit bird transactions. And I think in the early days there was kind of a, it was almost like fly fishing for me. Like I was hunting. I was becoming distracted by something that was completely separate from the war and my other life. But then it really just became thrilling because I started getting people to sing and I started, getting evidence. And then eventually I pulled a proposal for a book together and to my sort of relief, and we had just bought our first house and the mortgage payment was looming, and I had been stringing my wife along saying, like, no, I really think I can get a book deal. And fortunately there was I found a publisher in Viking for the book, and that really is what allowed me then to go full time and to finish the investigation to the extent that it could be finished.
Yeah. Well, and you do then eventually get a full interview with Edwin Rist, the young man that we're speaking about. He was engaging. He was likable. He was also a little arrogant. And ultimately, you think damning because, like him, what was the movie with Richard Gere where at the very last scene with, I think, Edward Norton, he sort of reveals himself to be a fraud? That is,
yes.
What's the movie I'm thinking of? But
I know exactly what you're talking about, and I'm blanking on it.
You had a scene like that where then he goes, yeah, I know how to do Asperger's. I know how to fake it, essentially. I don't know if he used the word fake, but he sort of revealed that's what he did.
Yeah, I'm paraphrasing a little bit from the book, but what he told me essentially was that he became what he needed to become at that point in his life. Because I had said, you know, like, I'm not an expert, and I don't want to sound like a jerk, but you don't seem like you have Asperger's to me. Like, you're making eye contact, and you're reading the subtext of all of my questions, and, none of the kind of classic markers. And he smiled, and he goes, yeah, I never had a problem with eye contact before. I don't have a problem now. It's just at that time, suddenly, I couldn't look at anyone's eyes. And then he started rocking gently back and forth, and he started avoiding my eye contact and rubbing his right hand on his right leg, and he was kind of like demonstrating what he had done during the evaluation. And I confronted the psychologist about this, and he said, well, yes, it could be faked, but here an expert would be able to detect that.
Yeah.
But that psychologist only spent an hour with him, and I've now spent 6 years of my life tracking this kid, and so
what a chilling moment. What a chilling moment when they make the movie. Oh my God, that will be the scene where then he just kind of winks at you. He didn't wink in the book, but in the movie I guarantee you he will. So Edwin Rist today is where?
He is performing in symphonies throughout Germany under a different name, which I did not reveal in the book. And he's free and just doing fine. I mean, I can't imagine that he likes this book very much.
And there's no such thing as double jeopardy in England either, I guess, huh? Once found not guilty, you can't be retried with the same evidence, huh?
I don't think so. But in this case, I think, one of the kickers to this whole story is that the birds have to be found with the labels tied to their feet, the original labels. Otherwise, the museum, as much as they might look like a museum specimen, just can't definitively ensure that it's theirs. And so, I could descend on a guy's house who I was certain had the rest of the birds with Interpol or Europol or any kind of law enforcement, and all that guy would have to do is just snip off the tags and throw them in the fire, and he'd be fine.
Yeah, right.
And I think they all know that. And so it's, I never imagined that. I mean, it took me 4 years to get him to talk. Over the period of that interview, I then concluded that there was an accomplice, and I never imagined that I would end up actually seeing some of the stolen stuff. But the story has always had some unimaginable dimensions to it.
And that's the truth. Well, for those of us that like Davis Abell or Susan Orlean, now we got to watch for everything that Kirk Wallace Johnson writes, because A, you got to have a good ear and eye for a story, and then you have to tell it this well. And you really did, Kirk. It's a pleasure reading the book, and it's a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, it's such an honor to be able to talk with you, too. Thank you for having me.
And I'll be honest with you, I was a little worried about you, because here's where I depart from the story with you just a little bit. I get the point about maybe Edwin is just faking it. Probably Edwin is faking it. But I also thought that the sort of person that can be that wrapped up in fly tying and the flute, and who I thought was maybe a little more socially awkward than you did. I wasn't there. I just read the book. I thought maybe he does have something about him different than you and me that makes this crime different than it would be for you and me. I mean, I gave him a little more rope on that than you did.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing was that I literally was worrying about you. I thought at some point, and you only touch on this in a paragraph very much towards the end of the book, and you didn't dwell on it, so I guess it wasn't a thought of yours, but I thought, isn't this your little obsession? Isn't this your thing? And it's almost ironic that the guy who's exposing these people is himself becoming drawn into the same sort of pull.
Yeah, you know, over the course of the investigation, I think I'm now at 4 new museum heists that I've uncovered by fly tires. And I know the identity of some of them, but I mean, I was just at the Los Angeles Natural History Museum for an event a few weeks ago, and the ornithologist motioned me over to a display, and he pointed out the crowbar marks where somebody had pried it open to steal some of these birds. When I excitedly told my wife that I had found there were 3 museums in Europe, and I think I know who did it, and she just groaned, and she's like, this isn't like all you do now, is it?
Is this what we are? Are you going to write another book? Do you have another? I mean, sure you are. What's the next story? Do you have one that you're also interested in?
I do, but I'm kind of superstitious about talking about it until I've got it cornered, so to speak. So
wow.
I'm in the process now of wrangling it.
Don't give the topic away, but write that book, and I'll talk to you again, Kirk.
Thank you so much. It's a real thrill to be on the show with you.